Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today is Super Tuesday, and a lot has changed over the past 24 hours. Many in the Democratic establishment and a few Republicans are now getting behind Joe Biden to stop Bernie Sanders. We've got Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, Harry Reid, John Kerry, Terry McAuliffe, Jim Clyburn, John Lewis, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor under Obama, and neocon Bill Kristol are all supporting Joe Biden. So will these Democrats and a few Republicans be able to stop Bernie Sanders, or will this be a contested election? And what about Elizabeth Warren? She says she still believes she has a path to victory, but she is barely being mentioned in much of the broadcast media. Joining us to talk about the latest are two guests. Gabrielle Gurley is deputy editor of the American Prospect, where she reports on state and local policy, infrastructure, and civil rights. Hi, Gabrielle. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Rose.
Thank you for joining us. Dee Dee Guttenplan is editor of The Nation magazine. They just endorsed Bernie Sanders yesterday, and he's also author of The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. Hi, Dee Dee. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So I just want to get you both to talk about what happened yesterday. Major, major changes with Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg dropping out of the race and then going to Texas to endorse Biden, along with the long list of Democrats that I mentioned. Gabrielle, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, excuse me, Amy Klobuchar was a little bit of a surprise. A lot of folks thought that she would at least hold out until after the Super Tuesday vote, but when you dig deeper into her position in Minnesota itself, she was becoming more and more apparently concerned about her strength in the state. Sanders has put up a good fight there, and she was not a shoo-in to take the state. She also faced some rather strong protesters Sunday night, forcing her to cancel a rally in Minnesota. So I guess she saw the handwriting on the wall, if you will, and decided suspend her campaign. As for Pete Buttigieg, I was also surprised that he did this before Super Tuesday, but it seems that the powers that be pulled in some of their heavy hitters to make him see reason. Presumably, one of those was Jimmy Carter, and that got headlines and quickly dropped out. But when you have one of the oldest living former president have you sit down and perhaps suggest that you need to think differently about your quest for the presidency, I'm sure that made him know that this was not happening for him, in addition to his very poor showing in South Carolina.
Right. And the New York Times also reports that former President Barack Obama spoke with Pete Buttigieg after he dropped out of the race. And this is according to a source who's familiar with the conversation. And
sure.
And they said that Obama didn't tell him that he should endorse Biden, but he did say, you know, you've got some major leverage here now. You should use it.
Exactly. And when you have former presidents calling you in kind of a 1-2 situation, it is time for you to think differently about your future in the party and in politics, in national politics, if you want to be a force on the national political scene. Obviously, Pete has endorsed Biden, so if Biden is the nominee and the eventual victor in November, he will be a force to be reckoned with. That is, Biden will have to find a place for him, perhaps, in the administration.
Dee Dee, what are your thoughts on this? I watched the cable shows for several hours last night, and what really struck me...
Did that enlighten you? I always find it melts my brain.
Well, it does melt my brain, but I figure for this job, I kind of have to do it. And I'm also just so curious to see how they're covering this. not surprising, but it was very blatant. It was Biden the entire 3 hours. They went to a Bernie rally for maybe a couple minutes. Anderson Cooper did interview Bernie last night. As far as Elizabeth Warren, they had some coverage of her rally before it started, but on MSNBC, but they never played any of her rally the entire night. It was Biden. In fact, they brought on a lot of Republicans to say Biden is back.
Well, let me take, there are a few pieces here. I mean, one is the Buttigieg and Klobuchar withdrawal. And I think that made sense for both of them because they were losing. And, you know, you can't keep bragging, as Amy Klobuchar did, that you win every race if you're going to lose so badly and possibly lose your home state. So, you know, part of, I think that actually, the fact that both of them were doing badly and forecast to continue doing badly was, frankly, much more of a factor than any phone call. Although I think, you know, Pete Buttigieg, as a careerist in this race, sees that he has leverage. I mean, I think Obama was absolutely right that if you sell when the market's high, you're going to do better. Certainly, being destroyed on Super Tuesday was not going to increase the value of Pete Buttigieg's endorsement. And he's a young guy, you know. I mean, it's almost impossible to think that he actually thought he was going to win running now. Whereas if he drops out now and endorses Biden, it's a win-win situation for him. I mean, if Biden wins, maybe he gets a cabinet job. And if Biden loses, then he's got a marker for running, you know, in 2024. And so I think that was a pretty easy decision for him to make. Now, in terms of the media coverage, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have been saying for a long time, obviously Bernie Sanders for a longer time, because Bernie's been saying pretty much everything he says for a longer time, that this system is rigged. And a big part of running again in a rigged system is that the media system is rigged. You know, we can all remember from 2016 that tweet that went around with all of the Washington Post headlines in one day attacking Sanders, and the fact that his campaign Intuit began winning and therefore became unavoidable, had a hard time getting coverage, certainly getting anything approaching sympathetic coverage, even on the supposedly liberal cable shows like MSNBC. You know, there are a few honorable exceptions, but mostly what he suffered was either contempt, condescension, or a total blackout. You know, and the fact that Warren is getting a total blackout now, I think, is unfair, and I think it's part of the general sexist treatment of her campaign all along. But I also don't think it's surprising. I mean, look, you can't say that the system is rigged and then complain that it's not a level playing field. I mean, what you have to do in a rigged system is you have to work twice as hard as the other side. You have to organize twice as hard. You have to make sure that you turn out all of your people and that you continue reaching out to people who aren't already on your side. And then maybe you have a chance of overwhelming a rigged system because, you know, as Shelley said, they are few, we are many, they are few. Our numbers is our only weapon. So we have to mobilize our numbers and use our numbers, and that's something that the Sanders campaign has been far more successful doing this time than they were last time, and also far more successful doing than Elizabeth Warren's campaign.
Gabrielle, what would you add?
I would add that Warren also did not do herself any favors. She ran a heavily focused policy campaign, which is great for an election nerd, public policy nerd like myself, but does not necessarily translate into appeal to voters. The last public policy focused campaign we saw in a presidential election was Hillary Clinton's, and we all know how that turned out. I think Warren, towards the middle end of her run, obviously Super Tuesday will finally determine, but it does not look good for the senator. She turned a little bit, particularly in the debates. She used Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, as a foil. And it was almost as Elizabeth Warren had come back to life and displayed some of her feistiness. But I think given the scenario that we're in, particularly with Trump being the focus, I don't think even among her partisans, there was a lot of faith that she could dispatch Trump. That's what I heard again and again from some progressives who really, really embraced her candidacy. But the question always was, can she beat Trump?
Right.
And I think that is and will continue to be, sadly, a problem for women candidates in general, but in this race in particular, that is the, you know, that is the end goal, and Elizabeth Warren could not make the sale.
Gabrielle Gurley is deputy editor of the American Prospect, where she reports on state and local policy, infrastructure, and civil rights. Dede Guttenplan is editor of The Nation magazine, and we're trying to get a better line for him. If you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts about just what happened in the last 24 hours with major Democrats getting behind Joe Biden? Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke was also there last night in Texas. You also have people like Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Susan Rice, former national security advisor under Obama. And then you've got Republicans like Senator John Warner and neocon Bill Kristol. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And in about 10 or so minutes, we'll be talking about get out the vote efforts. Go ahead, Gabrielle.
Yeah, if I could just add one thing about Pete Buttigieg. No matter what his future is, one thing that was proven in his campaign is he did not attract black or Latino voters by any significant margin. And until he demonstrates that he can do that, his path forward in the Democratic Party is always going to be perilous. And a part of the reason for that is his record in South Bend. He did not demonstrate that when he had the power to do contracting with minority businesses or instill black or Latino administrators in City Hall, he did not do that. He also was the mayor of the smallest of the cities that were represented in the presidential campaign. After all, you had two former mayors of New York, a former mayor of San Antonio, a former mayor of Newark, and even a mayor of Miramar, Florida, which is a larger city, all vying for the nomination, and yet it is Pete Buttigieg who ranks at the top, at least in that group. But once he's in a race, once he's put to a vote, he does not do well. And so that he has to do something to convince minority voters that he intends to make life better for people of color. And when he had the chance to do that, he did not live up to that promise.
Gabrielle, how would you assess Joe Biden's support? I mean, we've been talking over the last 2 weeks about the presidential candidates' records. And a few guests have said, you know, can we stop saying the black vote? Because it's not a monolith.
Exactly.
Right? And you have people who have very different views about issues. There are definitely differences between generations because some young black voters wrote op-eds about older black voters in South Carolina. What would you say about that?
I would say that there is a little bit of generational discord. Older black voters tend to know Joe Biden. He has the Obama glow, obviously, and that's the end of story for them. Younger voters want stronger action, and Bernie Sanders, for a lot of those voters, is the person to bring that to bear on American government. Now, as how that will shake out as we go forward will be interesting to see, but one thing that people should keep in mind, again, black voters are not a monolith, but I think if you lined up voters from 18 to 65 plus, the number one priority in November is ousting Donald Trump. And as this vote begins to coalesce once we get past Super Tuesday, I think people will close ranks behind whoever is in the lead. Younger folks, however, it does concern me that Biden will be a big disappointment for younger African American voters, and what they do with that disappointment if he gets the nomination is something that Democrats need to be concerned about. Older voters, if Sanders is the nominee, older voters will turn out regardless.
Don, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I just want to, I'm not sure I want to take issue with it. I just want to focus on something Gabrielle said, which is that after Super Tuesday, support will coalesce around the leader. I mean, I believe that was true, but I don't think it's true. I think what we've been seeing this past week, and particularly among corporate Democrats, those who expect to continue making a living as K Street lobbyists, and those who want to be able to shape the party by giving big contributions. Because don't forget, what distinguishes Sanders and Warren from every other candidate in this race is that they rely on a small donor base. They don't solicit from wealthy donors.
I was referring to the African American vote in particular. So,
pardon me.
I don't disagree with you, but I was referring to the African American vote in particular.
Ah, so you think the African American vote will coalesce around whoever is the leader? Well, I think that I'm more inclined to believe that because, as our columnist Ellie Mistal has observed, older African Americans have more experience than any other voting group in dealing with the realities of American politics. So I think that may well be true, but I also think that what we're going to see in the media, in fact, is an effort to prevent coalescing around the leader if the leader is Bernie Sanders.
And I don't disagree with that either, sure.
I think that's going to force an existential choice on everybody in this race, including Elizabeth Warren. I have to say that the Texas endorsement that surprised me was not Buttigieg or Klobuchar, since they were basically always in the same lane as Biden, the sort of centrist, let's turn the clock back to the good old days of 2012 lane, but Beto O'Rourke. And I think that was a more surprising to me endorsement in Texas. And I think, after Super Tuesday, and here I'm echoing Gabrielle's colleague David Dayan, who has a piece on Elizabeth Warren in The Prospect that makes a lot of the same points at greater length that we made in passing in our Nation editorial, which is still up on our website, which is that she has to decide which side she's on. She has every right to continue to run for president through the convention or through June, as Sanders did in 2016. And we are not arguing, certainly, that she should drop out, but we are arguing that her action going forward can really only aid one or the other of the front runners in this race. And, if she really is the candidate of progressive change, even if she carries on making her own case, which personally I hope she does, she needs to do it in a way that isn't usable by the other side as a weapon against Sanders. And that if she ends up objectively basically helping to wound Sanders, then she's chosen her side, and it's not the side of a progressive fight.
That is D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation magazine. We're also joined by Gabrielle Gurley, deputy editor of The American Prospect. And let's hear from a few callers on this. Let's go to Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I was at a panel discussion last week at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. And do you hear an echo?
You're fine.
Okay, cool. So this panel discussion was with John Perez. You may know the name. He's been an elected official in the state. Now he's chair of Board and Regents. Mark DiCamillo, the pollster. David Lauder, who is LA Times bureau chief. So the results are not surprising, that 34% of preference in Democratic polling is for Sanders. But I thought the breakdown of race and ethnicity and age was very interesting. For African Americans, Sanders 38%, Biden 10%. Asian American 37%, Biden 9%. And the same holds true for Warren, 14% African American preference, 10% Biden. Asian Americans for Warren, 13%, 9% for Biden. If you look at the age group, I mean, we're always hearing that, you know, Sanders support is with the young. So the 50 to 64-year-old group, you know, who may think they're young, 27% is for Sanders and 9% is for Biden. Okay. Even Warren beats Biden by double, 18% for Warren. 65 or older, 16% for Sanders and 11% for Biden. Biden really had a very poor showing overall in the state of California. Now, this all may change as of South Carolina and yesterday's endorsements, but I thought this was really telling. I was shocked when I looked at this breakdown again this morning to see the African-American and Asian-American support and Hispanic-American, definitely, in California is for either Sanders or Warren.
Well, thank you for that, Ruby. It is interesting. And Gabrielle and Don, Chuck Rocha is one of Bernie's top organizers, and he's been doing these videos about how they are going deep into the community in places where Democrats usually do not go. They're not bringing outsiders in. They're hiring local people. They're hiring local businesses. And they've got a really long game, like an 8-month game for in some places. And I'm not sure what it's like for Warren. I mean, I'm only bringing that up because Chuck Rocha is constantly on social media talking about the strategy. But Don, what about that? I mean, they're doing what most Democrats tend not to do.
Well, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I was in South Carolina in 2016, and after Hillary Clinton shellacked Bernie Sanders, I wrote a piece in The Nation pointing out all the flaws in the Sanders campaign in the state, including not really spending time with African-American voters, not going in deep into the community, not addressing their concerns, and not listening. And so it's nice to hear that some of those lessons have been learned. And I think, you know, when Gabrielle was talking about Buttigieg, I mean, if he really wants to run in 2024, that's what he's got to do. I mean, you know, people aren't stupid. You don't show up and offer them a bunch of shiny stuff and then they vote for you. They care if you've been around. They care if you've put in the time. I mean, to give Biden credit, I mean, what the reason that African-American voters are so loyal to him, at least older African-American voters, is not because they think that this is a man, remember, who eulogized Strom Thurmond. They don't think that he's Mr. Progressive on race. They think that he put in the time in the Obama administration, showing up to work every day and helping to support America's first black president. And, you know, that matters to people, rightfully, I think, more than what you promised them. So if you want to persuade them to look at you instead, you've got to really be on the ground, put in the time, be in the community, listen to people. And, you know, if the Sanders campaign wins California, and particularly if they do well among African American and Latinx voters and Asian American voters in the state, it'll be because of this kind of organizing.
Right. Anything to add there, Gabrielle, before we go to break?
Well, Sanders, don't underestimate, and I'm sure you do not, Sanders' fight the power message and how that resonates, particularly in the African American community. What Trump has done is basically galvanize African Americans you want the single most powerful get out the vote marker there is. It's Donald Trump. People will get out the vote. And I think if you look at What Sanders is saying, Sanders has those aspirations. He's putting those aspirations out there in a way, frankly, that no other candidate is.
Hmm. And he's still turning out thousands and thousands of people to his rallies.
Exactly.
On Saturday, more than 10,000 turned out for Bernie in Boston. On Sunday, 9,500 in San Jose. 15,000 came out in Los Angeles.
Hmm. And that bears watching, particularly with Bernie in Massachusetts. He's there in Elizabeth Warren's stomping grounds, making some inroads. And depending on how close that is, that also might be a decisive factor in what Elizabeth Warren does in the Super Tuesday aftermath, if she sees a problem for her going forward to 2024. If Bernie wins, and she is not at least somewhat close, she's going to have to think differently about her path forward, not only nationally, but in Massachusetts.
Right. Can you both stay with us for about 10 or so more minutes?
Sure.
Okay, great.
Sure.
Thank you. Gabrielle Gurley is deputy editor of The American Prospect, and D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation magazine and author of The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss results of Super Tuesday, and then we'll talk about what's next. Today, we're joined by Gabrielle Gurley, deputy editor of The American Prospect. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation magazine. And if you'd like to join us, we're going to stick on this topic for about 5 to 10 more minutes, and then we're going to switch gears and talk about Get Out the Vote efforts. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Before we go back to calls, I want to get you both to talk about Bloomberg, because it seemed like the Democratic establishment, whatever you want to call them, were going to line up behind Bloomberg to beat Bernie, to stop Bernie. And then when Biden won a big victory in South Carolina, things changed. Now, we just got word that Michael Bloomberg has spent more than $500 million on endless ads across the country. So, Gabrielle, what are your thoughts about Bloomberg now?
Well, they say that money changes everything, and this is probably one of the few cases where money doesn't necessarily change Bloomberg's chances of becoming president. I think Bloomberg's poor debate performances, he had a 1-2, courtesy of Elizabeth Warren, by the way, really poor performances. I was actually kind of shocked by how poorly he did, and that's a problem for him. Despite his record on things like climate change and fighting that crisis, he's not doing very well at all on the retail politics front, and ads do not substitute for that. In speaking with people in Maine for a report I did on the Maine primary, people were highly annoyed, and that is, the person said, that might actually galvanize people against Bloomberg. Is Bloomberg is seen as buying the presidency, which is kind of his MO right now. I don't see how that helps him. And that combined with the Sanders juggernaut and Biden coming up from the political dead almost doesn't bode well for Bloomberg.
Right. And then with Stop and Frisk getting so much attention,
exactly,
people sharing,
sure,
their personal stories. Just mm-hmm. recently in Selma, Alabama, Michael Bloomberg was speaking at a church and people stood up and turned their back to him.
Mm-hmm.
Don, exactly, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think, look, I live in New York. Michael Bloomberg is an arrogant jerk, and it's hard to hide that when you're on television. And, you know, being a billionaire probably hasn't helped him with his ego issues. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's way too soon to count him out, however, maybe because I'm a materialist, so I do think that money is a huge factor. I think, sure, they've put a lot of makeup on Joe Biden and jolted him back to life, but, you know, is that going to last? Is that going to last much past Super Tuesday? Is it going to last past Super Tuesday if Bernie wins California decisively and at least is, you know, very competitive in Texas, because those are the two big prizes tomorrow. I mean, the Bloomberg is plausible only because he's a billionaire and because the corporate elites think, well, Biden's hopeless and Bloomberg we won't have to pay for. Mm. Now, Biden briefly looked less hopeless, but let's remember, this guy was the front runner. So, you know, he blew a bigger lead than Hillary Clinton. Do we really think he's going to do better against Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton? I personally don't. And I think that as that becomes more obvious, and the alternative is Sanders, the billionaire class is going to turn to one of their own, unless they think that Biden is going to be able to block Sanders. Mm. So I think, you know, part of this is about blocking Sanders, and I think that it's way too soon to assume that Bloomberg won't be deployed to that end.
Right. Let's take a few callers because we have full lines, and then we'll get responses from Gabrielle and Don. Let's hear from Tony in San Francisco. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, last night I was over my niece's, and so all three of us were have different Democrats we're voting for, but we all came to the same conclusion that, one, there should be, first of all, mostly a holiday for the a federal holiday for the general election. Secondly, there should be one day to vote in the primary where all states are included. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, to abolish the Electoral College. And I just find that this is such a mess that's been created by, I don't know what, but just connecting the dots or whatever. And I think none of this would have happened if you had a date where you had to have your, if you're running for president, you were in, then you had a few debates, and then on, say, the Ides of March, we all vote for who we want for our choice for the primary. You wouldn't have this mess that's going on right now.
Well, thank you for that call. And just some really important information. Since you brought up, you know, no party preference and the fact that we're voting on a day when people don't have it off, if you do have a mail-in ballot, try to drop it off at a voting center or a polling place today. And if you don't, if you cannot do that, make sure it gets sent today, because some ballots do not get counted because they're sent too late. Now, if you do have a mail-in ballot and you voted for someone who is no longer running, you can go to your polling place and ask for a new ballot. So please spread the word about that. It's really important. And if you are no party preference, you can still go to a polling place if you want to vote for a Democrat and ask for a crossover ballot. So thank you so much for calling. Let's just take one more caller and then we'll move on to our other guests. Let's go to Atman in Cupertino. Hi, Atman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm amazed at how it's a sham, basically, because, and I think Sanders and maybe Warren should start a third party that will break the tie, because we saw that in the impeachment, and we saw that in 2008 when the Democrats and the Republicans decided to bail Wall Street with hundreds of billions of dollars. We saw that when the Fed printed $4 trillion, nobody said it's going to break this country. But now that Sanders wants people to have health care, they're saying it's going to break the country. And all those Democrats who were saying that they represent people and the voice of the people, they just folded and went with status quo to Biden. And it's really shameful what they are doing. And by the way, the Fed just lowered the interest rates for lending to banks just today. And they are saying that Sanders is going to break the country and going back to 2012 or 2008 regime or whatever. So that's my comment, and I'm just flabbergasted by the fake system that they are selling to our people.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, to that point, we'll talk more about this on tomorrow's show, but just briefly, because we have to switch gears. Don, do you really think that they'll take this to the convention, the establishment Democrats?
Well, I think they'll take it to the convention if they think they can prevent Bernie from being the nominee. The question is what they do at the convention. I think it's if they go to a second and third or whatever ballot, it will destroy the party. I mean, it's frankly impossible to imagine a case for giving the nomination to someone who didn't run at all or who ran and got fewer votes, you know, than the person with the most votes. Now, if it's, you know, Sanders 36%, Biden 34%, Bloomberg 20%, you could argue that there are more centrists than progressives. But that's what this is about. This is about a test of strength for which way the Democratic Party is going to go. And, you know, the Sanders people have had 4 years to prepare for it, so as has the party itself, and as have the party centrists. But that is the battle we're in, and there's no point kidding ourselves that this is going to be fun or that anybody's going to roll over.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is a fight, and, you know, you either back off the fight or you're in it.
Gabrielle, what are your final thoughts?
If I could just respond to the voter who mentioned the primary system, I think what you're going to see, particularly in the wake of problems in Iowa and possibly other states, we may not know who's having problems today, but we certainly will tomorrow. I think you'll see states that are further down in the calendar, New Jersey's in June, for example, I think you will see those states creep closer to a March, to Super Tuesday, or some date closer to Super Tuesday, if only to telegraph their relevance to the process.
Gabrielle Gurley is deputy editor of The American Prospect. Thank you so much for joining us, Gabrielle.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation magazine and author of The Next Republic, The Rise of a New Radical Majority. Thank you for joining us, Don.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. If you're just tuning in today, we are talking about Super Tuesday. So much has changed in the past 24 hours with Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg dropping out and endorsing Joe Biden. They were in Texas with him last night, along with Beto O'Rourke. He's got the support of a lot of other Democrats, Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, Harry Reid. And so the question is, will these Democrats be able to stop Bernie Sanders, or will it be a contested election? And then we bring up Elizabeth Warren because we've talked about this a lot. She's mostly been erased in a lot of the media coverage. Well, we're going to switch gears now and talk about voter turnout. And we're joined by Nicole Acevedo. Nicole is a staff reporter at NBC News and NBC Latino. She's from San Juan, Puerto Rico, and has published work for Latino USA, MSNBC, and other outlets. Hi, Nicole. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Great to have you. Julian Aguilar is an immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune, where he reports on politics and border affairs. Hi, Julian. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you both. And I should say we're not related, but I'm sure you're a great guy, Julian. We've had you many times. We'd love to meet in person one day. So let's talk about what we expect from voter turnout. A record 32 million Latinos are eligible to vote this time, and more than half of all eligible Latinx voters live in Super Tuesday states. So this is a major, major change. Julian, what are we expecting in terms of vote out in the Latino community?
You set it up perfectly with respect to the last 24 hours. So, you know, I think for primary voters that were waiting after the South Carolina primary to make a final decision, you know, I think Congressman O'Rourke, at least in Texas, who was really, really popular with the Gen Xers on down to millennials and younger, to see what kind of a bump he gives Vice President Biden. I think he set it up perfectly, because that was kind of threw everybody for a loop, just like the string of endorsements that came over. But on the flip side, you know, I covered a Bernie Sanders rally a week and a half ago here in El Paso, and it was a smaller venue, about 2,500 people, but it was packed. It had an overflow room, and the majority of those folks were younger voters that were out. I mean, you had some folks that, you know, live in nearby New Mexico, but they just kind of wanted to come out and hear Bernie Sanders' message and see what he was all about. So I think that's the definite split. But, you know, I'm glad you alluded to Elizabeth Warren also, because, you know, I got a lot of people posting on social media, like you said, saying, don't forget, you know, and they have the sort of breakdown of the delegates needed. And she's not too far behind the two front runners. So you know, it's going to come down to those three. But what a lot of people were mentioning during the slew of debates that we saw, you know, starting with, you know, from months ago, is that a lot of topics that, you know, are important to the Hispanic community weren't really discussed as much as they should be, not to say they were ignored. And obviously, you know, that's an immigration, border security issue. But, you know, Hispanic Texans also care about education and health care and other issues the way everybody else in Texas does.
You know, exactly, Julian. I think that what's so interesting about this race this time around is people are saying, can we just stop saying the black vote because it's not monolith? And then can we also stop saying that the only issue Latinos care about is immigration? Because obviously that's important, but they care about health care. They care about a living wage, child care. There's so many issues.
Sure, yeah. You know, in border areas, you know, it's often, you know, we struggle with the brain drain, you know, when a lot of these really bright, talented kids, you know, graduate high school and they want to see another part of the world from the border. And then, you know, of course, when they move away, they're going to be concerned about everyday issues. But yeah, I mean, the folks that I talked to at the Sanders rally, they were concerned with a lot of gun rights. Gun control folks wanted to see, you know, if he had something more to say. You know, he's kind of taken a little bit of a beating. And I think that's just particularly important to folks in El Paso because of what happened over the summer at the Walmart. And, you know, just this fear factor that created across the country for Latinos that they're going to be, you know, harassed and bullied. I think the shooting at the Walmart sort of put gun control to the forefront. But again, you know, like I said, Congressman O'Rourke, he's obviously very popular in El Paso and across the state. We saw when he was running for the U.S. Senate, I mean, he drew rallies of, you know, throngs of people that wanted to come out and say, you know, hear what he said. So we can argue until tomorrow, you know, the power of certain endorsements and whatnot. But if he had any pull and any sway towards undecided voters who are casting their ballots today in Texas, then, you know, it could help the vice president. So I guess it's just, you know, a waiting game, hopefully. And thankfully, you know, voting started about 5 hours here. And I've been looking at, you know, Twitter and Facebook, and I haven't seen any reports of, you know, any problems. There are really, really long lines, but early voting turnout was pretty stellar for, you know, compared to Texas's usual turnout. So that's going to be an interesting night, especially with what happened yesterday.
Yeah, very interesting. Nicole, you spoke with a number of Latinx millennial organizers in one of your latest articles for NBC News. What really stood out for you in those conversations?
I think what really stands out is that a lot of these folks feel like they're not included in the conversation whenever people talk about, quote unquote, the Latino vote. I think it's important to put in perspective that this is not only the nation's largest share of non-white voters, but also Latinos are among the youngest ethnic or racial populations in the country. The median age for a Latino person in this country is 30 years old. And about 40% of the eligible Latinos that can vote are between the ages of 18 and 35. So it's almost impossible to talk about the Latino vote without understanding its connection to the youth vote in this country. So I think that was the most surprising thing for me, talking to these organizers. And also when they're organizing in their communities, they're obviously rallying behind issues and not so much behind candidates. I had an organizer from Minnesota tell me, you know what, if you're a candidate that is talking about the issues that we care about, we will come to you, even if you don't come to us. And I thought that was really interesting because some of the polls that study the behavior of young voters in general in this country say that most candidates are not tapping into that potential. Hmm. Most of them are not engaging or are not reaching out to these voters in, as part of their campaign efforts. So, you know, depending on the demographic in terms of if they're 18 or they're 35, depending on what state they live, the issues they care about will change. But at the end of the day, if nobody reaches out for them, then it's a missed opportunity in that sense to harness these voters in states in Super Tuesday that most of the Latino voters live in.
Right. Nicole, you also point out that early voting in the top 10 counties in Texas for voter registration has been increasing.
Yeah, in the early voting process, like Julian mentioned, they saw a spike in these early votes in Texas. And one of the organizers I spoke there, especially I spoke with two organizers in Laredo and in Rio Grande, and they were saying, You know, we think of Texas as a non-voting state. So in the sense of like, it's hard. There's a lot of steps that go into registering voters and getting them to eventually vote. So actually early voting for them as organizers was a really strong indicator about, you know, their work organizing young people. They said, according to them, that they feel like these young people are driving this increase in early voting in Texas. And I think it's important to note, you know, when we talk about these young voters, especially young Latinos, what is the role that they play? So one organizer in Texas told me, you know, a lot of these young people are not just college students. They're heads of households. They need to take care of their parents. They maybe have kids. They work multiple jobs. And a lot of times they also serve as the main person in the families that helps navigate, especially if you're a mixed status family, that you have family members that may be undocumented or have a visa or a permanent residency, that they have all these different immigration status. Often these young Latinos are the ones helping their family navigate this country, and their opinion matters to them. Mm. So whenever they get involved and whenever they say, hey, I think this should be the top issues, and I think this candidate is speaking to them, it's actually very powerful. And again, according to polls that study youth voting behavior, that opportunity was not exploited by a lot of the candidates.
And Texas is so interesting because Donald Trump won Texas by 52.6% of the vote. Beto O'Rourke came very close to beating Ted Cruz for a Senate seat. And historically, national Democrats have mostly ignored Texas. A lot of people, especially in South Texas, say, you know what? The Bush family has come to visit, but we hardly hear from Democrats. So, Julian, what are your thoughts on this? Because Bernie Sanders held four rallies in Texas last weekend. Is there a better ground game now? I mean, so many people are wondering, when is Texas actually going to switch and actually vote for a Democrat for president?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the question here for now close to three decades, right? I mean, no Texas Democrat has won a statewide race even since former Governor Ann Richards in the 90s did that. So there's always been this talk about, you know, well, when the Hispanic vote, you know, it's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason. You know, the sleeping giant that is the Latino vote, you know, that's been pressing the snooze button every 2 and 4 years for the last, you know, 20-some-odd years. But I think you're right. I think it is indicative of the fact that, my Bloomberg came within, you know, just the days after he formally announced, he had already planned an El Paso rally. So he can try to appeal to the, you know, the more moderate, older generation of Democrats. But with respect to what you asked about Bernie Sanders, I mean, I think that's why he's doing so well. Up until 3 days ago, he was leading the polls among Texas Latinos because a lot of what I heard at his rally was like, you know, the fact that he had a rally here in El Paso the same day as the Nevada caucuses, you know, left Vegas and came here instead of, you know, rallying any last-minute voters. They said, well, that shows that, you know, he's at least caring about the border and caring about Texas, which, to your point, not a lot of folks have come to visit because they just assume it's going to go red. Now, you know, I think even the most optimistic Democrat will not expect any sort of, you know, blue tsunami come November. But, you know, they're hopeful that at least Texas Democrats will be able to gain the state house back that they haven't done, you know, for probably two decades, I think now. And, you know, they gained 12 seats the last go around in the Texas State House. The Democrats did. They need 9 more to have control of the lower chamber, but they also need to keep those 12 that they gained. And 5 of those seats were between 3.5 percentage points and fewer. So it shows that, I mean, it goes to show that the party is making gains, but it's going to take a little bit longer, I think, you know, before they have a sweep or they control the majority of federal and statewide races.
Nicole, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think that whenever we talk about the sleeping giant, right, and we've been talking about it for so long, at least last time around in 2018 during the midterms, we saw some sort of indication that things were tipping to the other way. So basically, almost like poking the so-called sleeping giant to wake up, and it feels like there's a possibility there. But I think that, you know, a lot of it has to do because people don't realize, even though the 32 million voters that are Latino and are eligible to vote, that only represents half of the Latino population in this country. There are 60 million Latinos living in this country right now, according to census data. And I think that, you know, when we talk about the sleeping giant, maybe we have to be more nuanced in the way we talk about it. And right now, a lot of the growth in the Latino community in terms of population is driven by people being born in this country and the younger generation coming of age, being adults. So I think that maybe it is waking up, but I don't think it's waking up in the way people expected years back.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us and for all of your reporting. And we'd love to have you both back to continue talking about the results. And it's going to be so fascinating to find out what happens tonight. Nicole Acevedo is a staff reporter at NBC News and NBC Latino. She's from San Juan, Puerto Rico, and has also published work for Latino USA. Thank you for joining us, Nicole.
Thank you.
Julian Aguilar is an immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune, where he reports on politics and border affairs. Julian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And we just got an email from Mark who says, if you do bring a vote by mail ballot to a polling station, be sure to also bring your envelope. Thank you so much for that, Mark. Again, if you do have a mail-in ballot and you haven't mailed it in, it'd be better to bring it to a polling center today just to make sure it gets counted, or be sure to put it in the mail sometime this morning or this afternoon if you're living in California. And if you also voted for a candidate who's no longer in the race, you can take the ballot to a polling station and ask for a new ballot. And also, if you're no party preference and you want to vote for a Democrat, you still have time to take that ballot to a polling place and ask for a crossover ballot. It's still kind of early, but so far we don't see any major problems, luckily, happening here in California. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about all of the results today, find out what they mean and what is next. If you see any good articles, please email it to us, yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine and Jonathan Linden for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr, our studio engineer. You can find more information about the show and listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.